workmen, and girls with a piece of chocolate in one hand and a croissant in the other were pouring into the metro stations. Trams, filled with more workmen, boomed gloomily past. One hastened down to the station, fought for a place. One does literally have to fight on the Paris metro at 6 in the morning, and stood jammed in the swaying mass of passengers, nose to nose with some hideous French face, breathing sour wine and garlic. And then one descended into the labyrinth of the hotel basement and forgot daylight till 2 o'clock, when the sun was hot and the town black with people and cars. After my first week at the hotel, I always spent the afternoon interval in sleeping, or when I had money, in a bistro. Except for a few ambitious waiters who went to English classes, the whole staff wasted their leisure in this way. One seemed too lazy after the morning's work to do anything better. Sometimes half a dozen plongeurs would make up a party and go to an abominable brothel in the Rue de Saïs, where the charge was only 5 francs 25 centimes, tenpence halfpenny. It was nicknamed Le Prefix, and they used to describe their experiences there as a great joke. It was a favourite rendezvous of hotel workers. The plongeurs' wages did not allow them to marry, and no doubt work in the basement does not encourage fastidious feelings. For another 4 hours one was in the cellars, and then one emerged sweating into the cool street. It was lamplight, that strange purplish gleam of the Paris lamps, and beyond the river the Eiffel Tower flashed from top to bottom with zigzag sky signs like enormous snakes of fire. Streams of cars glided silently to and fro, and women, exquisite looking in the dim light, strolled up and down the arcade. Sometimes a woman would glance at Boris or me, and then, noticing our greasy clothes, look hastily away again. One fought another battle in the metro, and was home by 10. Generally from 10 to midnight, I went to a little bistro in our street, an underground place frequented by Arab navvies. It was a bad place for fights, and I sometimes saw bottles thrown, once with fearful effect. But as a rule, the Arabs fought among themselves and let the Christians alone. Raki, the Arab drink, was very cheap, and the bistro was open at all hours, for the Arabs, lucky men, had the power of working all day and drinking all night. It was the typical life of a plongeur, and it didn't seem a bad life at the time. I had no sensation of poverty, for even after paying my rent and setting aside enough for tobacco and journeys and my food on Sundays, I still had 4 francs a day for drinks, and 4 francs was wealth. There was, it's hard to express it, a sort of heavy contentment. The contentment a well-fed beast might feel in a life which had become so simple. For nothing could be simpler than the life of a plongeur. He lives in a rhythm between work and sleep, without time to think, hardly conscious of the exterior world. His Paris has shrunk to the hotel, the metro, a few bistros, and his bed. If he goes afield, it is only a few streets away, on a trip with some servant girl who sits on his knees swallowing oysters and beer. On his free day, he lies in bed till noon, puts on a clean shirt, throws dice for drinks, and after lunch goes back to bed again. Nothing is quite real to him but the boulot, drinks, and sleep. And of these, sleep is the most important. One night in the small hours, there was a murder just beneath my window. I was woken by a fearful uproar, and going to the window saw a man lying flat on the stones below. I could see the murderers, 3 of them, flitting away at the end of the street. Some of us went down and found that the man was quite dead, his skull cracked with a piece of lead piping. I remember the colour of his blood, curiously purple, like wine. It was still on the cobbles when I came home that evening, and they said that the school children had come from miles round to see it. But the thing that strikes me in looking back is that I was in bed and asleep within 3 minutes of the murder. So were most of the people in the street. We just made sure that the man was done for and went straight back to bed. We were working people. And where was the sense of wasting sleep over a murder? Work in the hotel taught me the true value of sleep, just as being hungry had taught me the true value of food. Sleep had ceased to be a mere physical necessity. It was something voluptuous, a debauch more than a relief. I had no more trouble with the bugs. Mario had told me of a sure remedy for them, namely pepper, strewn thick over the bedclothes. It made me sneeze, but the bugs all hated it and emigrated to other rooms. Chapter 17. With 30 francs a week to spend on drinks, I could take part in the social life of the quarter. We had some jolly evenings on Saturdays in the little bistro at the foot of the Hôtel des Trois Moineaux. The brick-floored room, 15 feet square, was packed with 20 people, and the air dim with smoke. The noise was deafening, for everyone was either talking at the top of his voice or singing. Sometimes it was just a confused din of voices. Sometimes everyone would burst out together in the same song, the Marseillaise, or the Internationale, or Madelon, or Les Fraises et les Framboises. Azaya, a great, clumping peasant girl who worked 14 hours a day in a glass factory, sang a song about Il a perdu ses pantalons tout en dansant le charlatan. Her friend Marinette, a thin, dark Corsican girl of obstinate virtue, tied her knees together and danced the danse du ventre. The old Rougier wandered in and out, cadging drinks and trying to tell a long, involved story about someone who had once cheated them over a bedstead. R, cadaverous and silent, sat in his corner, quietly boozing. Charlie, drunk, half-danced, half-staggered to and fro, with a glass of sham absinthe balanced in one fat hand, pinching the women's breasts and declaiming poetry. People played darts and diced for drinks. Manuel, a Spaniard, dragged the girls to the bar and shook the dice box against their bellies for luck. Madame F. stood at the bar, rapidly pouring chopine of wine through the pewter funnel, with a wet dishcloth always handy, because every man in the room tried to make love to her. Two children, bastards of Big Louis the bricklayer, sat in a corner, sharing a glass of sirop. Everyone was very happy, overwhelmingly certain that the world was a good place, and we a notable set of people. For an hour the noise scarcely slackened. Then, about midnight, there was a piercing shout of "Citoyen!" and the sound of a chair falling over. A blonde, red-faced workman had risen to his feet and was banging a bottle on the table. Everyone stopped singing. The word went round. "Shh! Furex is starting." Furex was a strange creature, a Limousin stonemason who worked steadily all the week and drank himself into a kind of paroxysm on Saturdays. He had lost his memory and could not remember anything before the war, and he would have gone to pieces through drink if Madame F. had not taken care of him. On Saturday evenings, at about 5 o'clock, she would say to someone, "Catch Ferex before he spends his wages," and when he had been caught, she would take away his money, leaving him enough for one good drink. One week he escaped, and rolling blind drunk in the Place Mange, was run over by a car and badly hurt. The queer thing about Furex was that though he was a communist when sober, he turned violently patriotic when drunk. He started the evening with good communist principles, but after 4 or 5 litres he was a rampant chauvinist, denouncing spies, challenging all foreigners to fight, and if he was not prevented, throwing bottles. It was at this stage that he made his speech, for he made a patriotic speech every Saturday night. The speech was always the same, word for word. It ran, "Citizens of the Republic, are there any Frenchmen here? If there are any Frenchmen here, I rise to remind them in effect of the glorious days of the war. When one looks back upon that time of comradeship and heroism, one looks back in effect upon that time of comradeship and heroism. When one remembers the heroes who are dead, one remembers in effect the heroes who are dead. Citizens of the Republic, I was wounded at Verdun." Here he partially undressed and showed the wound he had received at Verdun. There were shouts of applause. We thought nothing in the world could be funnier than this speech of Furex's. He was a well-known spectacle in the quarter. People used to come in from other bistros to watch him when his fit started. The word was passed round to bait Furex. With a wink to the others, someone called for silence and asked him to sing the Marseillaise. He sang it well, in a fine bass voice, with patriotic gurgling noises deep down in his chest when he came to Aux armes citoyennes, fermez vos bataillons. Veritable tears rolled down his cheeks. He was too drunk to see that everyone was laughing at him. Then, before he had finished, two strong workmen seized him by either arm and held him down, while Isaiah shouted, Vive l'Allemagne! Just out of his reach. Furex's face went purple at such infamy. Everyone in the bistro began shouting together, Vive l'Allemagne! A bas la France! While Furex struggled to get at them. But suddenly he spoiled the fun. His face turned pale and doleful, his limbs went limp, and before anyone could stop him, he was sick on the table. Then Madame F. hoisted him like a sack and carried him up to bed. In the morning, he reappeared quiet and civil, and bought a copy of L'Humanité. The table was wiped with a cloth. Madame F. brought more liter bottles and loaves of bread, and we settled down to serious drinking. There were more songs. An itinerant singer came in with his banjo and performed for 5 sous pieces. An Arab and a girl from the bistro down the street did a dance, the man wielding a painted wooden phallus the size of a rolling pin. There were gaps in the noise now. People had begun to talk about their love affairs and the war and the barbel fishing in the Seine and the best way to faire la révolution and to tell stories. Charlie, grown sober again, captured the conversation and talked about his soul for 5 minutes. The doors and windows were opened to cool the room. The street was emptying, and in the distance one could hear the lonely milk train thundering down the Boulevard Saint-Michel. The air blew cold on our foreheads, and the coarse African wine still tasted good. We were still happy, but meditatively, with the shouting and hilarious mood finished. By 1 o'clock, we were not happy any longer. We felt the joy of the evening wearing thin and called hastily for more bottles. But Madame F. was watering the wine now, and it did not taste the same. Men grew quarrelsome, the girls were violently kissed and hands thrust into their bosoms, and they made off lest worse should happen. Big Louis, the bricklayer, was drunk and crawled about the floor barking and pretending to be a dog. The others grew tired of him and kicked at him as he went past. People seized each other by the arm and began long, rambling confessions and were angry when these were not listened to. The crowd thinned. Manuel and another man, both gamblers, went across to the Arab bistro, where card playing went on till daylight. Charlie suddenly borrowed 30 francs from Madame F. and disappeared, probably to a brothel. Men began to empty their glasses, call briefly, Sir Dame, and go off to bed. By 1:30, the last drop of pleasure had evaporated, leaving nothing but headaches. We perceived that we were not splendid inhabitants of a splendid world, but a crew of underpaid workmen grown squalidly and dismally drunk. We went on swallowing the wine, but it was only from habit, and the stuff seemed suddenly nauseating. One's head had swollen up like a balloon, the floor rocked, one's tongue and lips were stained purple. At last it was no use keeping it up any longer. Several men went out into the yard behind the bistro and were sick. We crawled up to bed, tumbled down half-dressed, and stayed there 10 hours. Most of my Saturday nights went in this way. On the whole, the 2 hours when one was perfectly and wildly happy seemed worth the subsequent headache. For many men in the quarter, unmarried and with no future to think of, the weekly drinking bout was the one thing that made life worth living. Chapter 18. Charlie told us a good story one Saturday night in the bistro. Try and picture him. Drunk, but sober enough to talk consecutively. He bangs on the zinc bar and yells for silence. Silence, messieurs et dames, silence, I implore you. Listen to this story that I am about to tell you. A memorable one, an instructive story, one of the souvenirs of a refined and civilized life. Silence, messieurs et dames. It happened at a time when I was hard up. You know what it's like. How damnable that a man of refinement should ever be in such a condition. My money had not come from home. I had pawned everything, and there was nothing open to me except to work, which is a thing I will not do. I was living with a girl at the time. Yvonne, her name was, a great half-witted peasant girl like Isaiah there, with yellow hair and fat legs. The two of us had eaten nothing in 3 days. Mon Dieu, what sufferings! The girl used to walk up and down the room with her hands on her belly, howling like a dog that she was dying of starvation. It was terrible. But to a man of intelligence, nothing is impossible. I propounded to myself the question, what is the easiest way to get money without working? And immediately the answer came, to get money easily, one must be a woman. Has not every woman something to sell? And then, as I lay reflecting upon the things I should do if I were a woman, an idea came into my head. I remembered the government maternity hospitals. You know the government maternity hospitals? They are places where women who are enceinte are given meals free and no questions are asked. It is done to encourage childbearing. Any woman can go there and demand a meal, and she is given it immediately. Oh, dear, I thought, if only I were a woman. I would eat at one of those places every day. Who can tell whether a woman is enceinte or not without an examination? I turned to Yvonne. Stop that insufferable bawling, I said. I have thought of a way to get food. How? Said she. It is simple, I said. Go to the government maternity hospital. Tell them you are enceinte and ask for food. They will give you a good meal and ask no questions. Yvonne was appalled. Mais mon Dieu, she cried, I am not enceinte. Who cares, I said, that is easily remedied. What do you need except a cushion? Two cushions, if necessary. It's an inspiration from heaven, ma chère, don't waste it. Well, in the end, I persuaded her, and then we borrowed a cushion, and I got her ready and took her to the maternity hospital. They received her with open arms. They gave her cabbage soup, a ragout of beef, a puree of potatoes, bread and cheese and beer, and all kinds of advice about her baby. Yvonne gorged till she almost burst her skin, and managed to slip some of the bread and cheese into her pocket for me. I took her there every day until I had money again. My intelligence had saved us. Everything went well until a year later. I was with Yvonne again, and one day we were walking down the Boulevard Port-Royal near the barracks. Suddenly Yvonne's mouth fell open, and she began turning red and white and red again. Mon Dieu, she cried, look at that, who's coming? It's the nurse who's in charge at the maternity hospital. I'm ruined. Quick, I said, run. But it was too late. The nurse had recognised Yvonne, and she came straight up to us, smiling. She was a big fat woman, with a gold pince-nez and red cheeks like the cheeks of an apple, a motherly, interfering kind of woman. I hope you're well, ma petite, she said kindly, and your baby, is he well too? Was it a boy, as you were hoping? Yvonne had begun trembling so hard that I had to grip her arm. No, she said at last. Ah, then, évidemment, it was a girl. Thereupon Yvonne, the idiot, lost her head completely. No, she actually said again. The nurse was taken aback. Comment? She exclaimed. Neither a boy nor a girl. But how can that be? Figure to yourself, Monsieur Redam, it was a dangerous moment. Yvonne had turned the colour of a beetroot, and she looked ready to burst into tears. Another second, and she would have confessed everything. Heaven knows what might have happened. But as for me, I had kept my head. I stepped in and saved the situation. It was twins, I said calmly. Twins, exclaimed the nurse, and she was so pleased that she took Yvonne by the shoulders and embraced her on both cheeks, publicly. Yes, twins. Chapter 19. One day, when we had been at the Hotel X 5 or 6 weeks, Boris disappeared without notice. In the evening, I found him waiting for me in the Rue de Rivoli. He slapped me gaily on the shoulder. Free at last, mon ami. You can give notice in the morning. The auberge opens tomorrow. Tomorrow? Well, possibly we shall need a day or two to arrange things, but at any rate, no more cafeterie. Nous sommes lancés, mon ami. My tailcoat is out of pawn already. His manner was so hearty that I felt sure there was something wrong. And I didn't at all want to leave my safe and comfortable job at the hotel. However, I had promised Boris, so I gave notice, and the next morning at 7 went down to the Auberge de Jean Cottard. It was locked, and I went in search of Boris, who had once more bolted from his lodgings and taken a room in the Rue de la Croix-en-Hiver. I found him asleep, together with a girl whom he had picked up the night before and who he told me was of a very sympathetic temperament. As to the restaurant, he said that it was all arranged. There were only a few little things to be seen to before we opened. At 10, I managed to get Boris out of bed, and we unlocked the restaurant. At a glance, I saw what the few little things amounted to. It was briefly this, that the alterations had not been touched since our last visit. The stoves for the kitchen had not arrived, the water and electricity had not been laid on, and there was all manner of painting, polishing, and carpentering to be done. Nothing short of a miracle could open the restaurant within 10 days, and by the look of things, it might collapse without even opening. It was obvious what had happened. The patron was short of money, and he had engaged the staff, there were four of us, in order to use us instead of workmen. He would be getting our services almost free, for waiters are paid no wages, and though he would have to pay me, he would not be feeding me till the restaurant opened. In effect, he had swindled us of several hundred francs by sending for us before the restaurant was open. We had thrown up a good job for nothing. Boris, however, was full of hope. He had only one idea in his head, namely, that here at last was a chance of being a waiter and wearing a tail coat once more. For this he was quite willing to do 10 days' work unpaid, with the chance of being left jobless in the end. "Patience," he kept saying. "That will arrange itself. Wait till the restaurant opens and we'll get it all back. Patience, mon ami." We needed patience. For days passed, and the restaurant did not even progress towards opening. We cleaned out the cellars, fixed the shelves, distempered the walls, polished the woodwork, whitewashed the ceiling, stained the floor. But the main work, the plumbing and gas fitting and electricity, was still not done, because the patron could not pay the bills. Evidently he was almost penniless, for he refused the smallest charges, and he had a trick of swiftly disappearing when asked for money. His blend of shiftiness and aristocratic manners made him very hard to deal with. Melancholy duns came looking for him at all hours, and by instruction we always told them that he was at Fontainebleau, or Saint-Cloud, or some other place that was safely distant. Meanwhile, I was getting hungrier and hungrier. I had left the hotel with 30 francs, and I had to go back immediately to a diet of dry bread. Boris had managed in the beginning to extract an advance of 60 francs from the patron, but he'd spent half of it in redeeming his waiter's clothes, and half on the girl of sympathetic temperament. He borrowed 3 francs a day from Jules, the second waiter, and spent it on bread. Some days we hadn't even money for tobacco. Sometimes the cook came to see how things were getting on, and when she saw that the kitchen was still bare of pots and pans, she usually wept. Jules, the second waiter, refused steadily to help with the work. He was a Magyar, a little dark, sharp-featured fellow in spectacles and very talkative. He had been a medical student, but had abandoned his training for lack of money. He had a taste for talking while other people were working, and he told me all about himself and his ideas. It appeared that he was a communist, and had various strange theories. He could prove to you by figures that it was wrong to work. And he was also, like most Magyars, passionately proud. Proud and lazy men do not make good waiters. It was Jules' dearest boast that once, when a customer in a restaurant had insulted him, he had poured a plate of hot soup down the customer's neck, and then walked straight out without even waiting to be sacked. As each day went by, Jules grew more and more enraged at the trick the patron had played on us. He had a spluttering, oratorical way of talking. He used to walk up and down, shaking his fist and trying to incite me not to work. "Put that brush down, you fool. You and I belong to proud races. We don't work for nothing like these damned Russian serfs. I tell you, to be cheated like this is torture to me. There have been times in my life when someone has cheated me even a 5 sous, when I have vomited, yes, vomited with rage. Besides, mon vieux, don't forget that I am a communist. À bas la bourgeoisie! Did any man alive ever see me working when I could avoid it? No. And not only I don't wear myself out working like you other fools, but I steal just to show my independence. Once I was in a restaurant where the patron thought he could treat me like a dog. Well, in revenge, I found out a way to steal milk from the milk cans and seal them up again so that no one should know. I tell you, I just swilled that milk down night and morning. Every day, I drank 4 litres of milk, besides half a litre of cream. The patron was at his wit's end to know where the milk was going. It wasn't that I wanted milk, you understand, because I hate the stuff. It was principle, just principle. Well, after 3 days, I began to get dreadful pains in my belly, and I went to the doctor. "What have you been eating?" he said. I said, "I drink 4 litres of milk a day and half a litre of cream." "4 litres," he said. "Then stop it at once. You'll burst if you go on." "What do I care?" I said. "With me, principle is everything. I shall go on drinking that milk even if I do burst." Well, the next day the patron caught me stealing milk. "You're sacked," he said. "You leave at the end of the week." "Pardon, monsieur," I said. "I shall leave this morning." "No, you won't," he said. "I can't spare you till Saturday." "Very well, mon patron," I thought to myself, "we'll see who gets tired of it first." And then I set to work to smash the crockery. I broke 9 plates the first day and 13 the second. After that, the patron was glad to see the last of me. "Ah, I'm not one of your Russian muzhiks." 10 days passed. It was a bad time. I was absolutely at the end of my money and my rent was several days overdue. We loafed about the dismal empty restaurant, too hungry even to get on with the work that remained. Only Boris now believed that the restaurant would open. He had set his heart on being maître d'hôtel, and he invented a theory that the patron's money was tied up in shares, and he was waiting a favourable moment for selling. On the 10th day, I had nothing to eat or smoke, and I told the patron that I could not continue working without an advance on my wages. As blandly as usual, the patron promised the advance, and then, according to his custom, vanished. I walked part of the way home, but I didn't feel equal to a scene with Madame F. over the rent, so I passed the night on a bench on the boulevard. It was very uncomfortable. The arm of the seat cuts into your back, and much colder than I had expected. There was plenty of time in the long, boring hours between dawn and work to think what a fool I had been to deliver myself into the hands of these Russians. Then in the morning, the luck changed. Evidently, the patron had come to an understanding with his creditors, for he arrived with money in his pockets, set the alterations going, and gave me my advance. Boris and I bought macaroni and a piece of horse's liver and had our first hot meal in 10 days. The workmen were brought in and the alterations made, hastily and with incredible shoddiness. The tables, for instance, were to be covered with baize, but when the patron found that baize was expensive, he bought instead disused army blankets, smelling incorrigibly of sweat. The tablecloths, they were Czech to go with the Norman decorations, would cover them, of course. On the last night, we were at work till 2 in the morning getting things ready. The crockery did not arrive till 8, and being new, had all to be washed. The cutlery did not arrive till the next morning, nor the linen either, so that we had to dry the crockery with a shirt of the patron's and an old pillow slip belonging to the concierge. Boris and I did all the work. Jules was skulking, and the patron and his wife sat in the bar with a dun and some Russian friends, drinking success to the restaurant. The cook was in the kitchen with her head on the table, crying, because she was expected to cook for 50 people, and there were not pots and pans enough for 10. About midnight, there was a fearful interview with some duns who came intending to seize 8 copper saucepans, which the patron had obtained on credit. They were bought off with 1/2 bottle of brandy. Jules and I missed the last metro home, and had to sleep on the floor of the restaurant. The first thing we saw in the morning were 2 large rats sitting on the kitchen table, eating from a ham that stood there. It seemed a bad omen, and I was surer than ever that the Auberge de Jeanne Cottard would turn out a failure. Chapter 20. The patron had engaged me as kitchen plongeur. That is, my job was to wash up, keep the kitchen clean, prepare vegetables, make tea, coffee and sandwiches, do the simpler cooking, and run errands. The terms were, as usual, 500 francs a month and food, but I had no free day and no fixed working hours. At the Hotel X, I had seen catering at its best, with unlimited money and good organisation. Now, at the Auberge, I learned how things are done in a thoroughly bad restaurant. It is worth describing, for there are hundreds of similar restaurants in Paris, and every visitor feeds in one of them occasionally. I should add, by the way, that the Auberge was not the ordinary cheap eating house frequented by students and workmen. We did not provide an adequate meal at less than 25 francs, and we were picturesque and artistic, which sent up our social standing. There were the indecent pictures in the bar, and the Norman decorations, sham beams on the walls, electric lights done up as candlesticks, peasant pottery, even a mounting block at the door. And the patron and the head waiter were Russian officers, and many of the customers titled Russian refugees. In short, we were decidedly chic. Nevertheless, the conditions behind the kitchen door were suitable for a pigsty, for this is what our service arrangements were like. The kitchen measured 15 feet long by 8 broad, and half this space was taken up by the stoves and tables. All the pots had to be kept on shelves out of reach, and there was only room for one dustbin. This dustbin used to be crammed full by midday, and the floor was normally an inch deep in a compost of trampled food. For firing, we had nothing but 3 gas stoves without ovens, and all joints had to be sent out to the bakery. There was no larder. Our substitute for one was a half-roofed shed in the yard, with a tree growing in the middle of it. The meat, vegetables and so forth lay there on the bare earth, raided by rats and cats. There was no hot water laid on. Water for washing up had to be heated in pans, and as there was no room for these on the stoves when meals were cooking, most of the plates had to be washed in cold water. This, with soft soap and the hard Paris water, meant scraping the grease off with bits of newspaper. We were so short of saucepans that I had to wash each one as soon as it was done with, instead of leaving them till the evening. This alone wasted probably an hour a day. Owing to some scamping of expense in the installation, the electric light usually fused at 8 in the evening. The patron would only allow us 3 candles in the kitchen, and the cook said 3 were unlucky, so we had only 2. Our coffee grinder was borrowed from a bistro nearby, and our dustbin and brooms from the concierge. After the first week, a quantity of linen didn't come back from the wash, as the bill was not paid. We were in trouble with the inspector of labour, who had discovered that the staff included no Frenchmen. He had several private interviews with the patron, who, I believe, was obliged to bribe him. The electric company was still dunning us, and when the duns found that we would buy them off with apéritif, they came every morning. We were in debt at the grocery, and credit would have been stopped, only the grocer's wife, a moustachioed woman of 60, had taken a fancy to Jules, who was sent every morning to cajole her. Similarly, I had to waste an hour every day haggling over vegetables in the Rue du Commerce to save a few centimes. These are the results of starting a restaurant on insufficient capital, and in these conditions the cook and I were expected to serve 30 or 40 meals a day, and would later on be serving 100. From the first day it was too much for us. The cook's working hours were from 8 in the morning till midnight, and mine from 7 in the morning till 12:30 the next morning. 17.5 hours, almost, without a break. We never had time to sit down till 5 in the afternoon, and even then there was no seat except the top of the dustbin. Boris, who lived nearby and had not to catch the last metro home, worked from 8 in the morning till 2 the next morning. 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. Such hours, though not usual, are nothing extraordinary in Paris. Life settled at once into a routine that made the Hotel X seem like a holiday. Every morning at 6 I drove myself out of bed, did not shave, sometimes washed, hurried up to the Place d'Italie, and fought for a place on the metro. By 7 I was in the desolation of the cold, filthy kitchen with the potato skins and bones and fishtails littered on the floor, and a pile of plates stuck together in their grease, waiting from overnight. I couldn't start on the plates yet, because the water was cold, and I had to fetch milk and make coffee, for the others arrived at 8 and expected to find coffee ready. Also, there were always several copper saucepans to clean.